good in that.
Thank you.
Okay.
I know.
Ready?
Gets me in charge.
That sounds like yes.
There's Byron.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, I'd like to call this meeting to order of the Overton Power District Number 5, April 17th at 3 p.m. in the Mesquite office. Is there any public comment? Do I hear a motion for acceptance of the agenda?
I'll accept a motion to accept the agenda.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded that we accept the agenda for today's meeting. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Do I hear a motion for approval of the minutes of the previous meeting held March 20th, 2024?
Sorry.
Uh-oh.
There you go. Is that better, Jim?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's past better.
Okay.
Okay. Do I hear a motion on the minutes?
I'll move. We approve the minutes as presented for March 20th in Overton.
I'll second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded to approve the minutes of the previous meeting. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Chair's report. I'm not going to interfere with what you have to tell us. But I have my little thing that says that I went and watched that hot dog fry. And it was really good. I thought it was really exciting to have it there. And I love hearing the kids go, oh! It was fun. Thanks for doing that. It was really nice. And your crew was fabulous. That's my report for today.
I don't know what it is, but my grandson told me he wanted to eat the hot dogs that got blown up there. All the kids want to eat the hot dogs that get blown up.
Well, you know what? If you like charred hot dogs, next time have buns.
Much copper in those.
Never to eat a hot dog again.
I don't know. You kept feeding them to them. Okay, attorney's report.
I don't have anything at this time, unless anyone has questions.
Okay, manager's report.
Admin, Scott, will you lead us off, please?
I love starting us off. It's my favorite thing. Okay, cybersecurity report this month, April. Our cybersecurity training was excellent at 100%. For the month of March, we had one person click on our phishing. These are a couple of the example emails. I believe that the email that was clicked on was this one. Had to do with W-2s. 1095C tax information downloaded there, and they clicked on it. We got them. We don't want to get them, but we get them from time to time. Email spam this month, 43,000 emails, 1,981 of that was spam. Those are the firewall blocks by country. Server system uptime remains 100%, and our data backup restoration, Dell, you probably noticed it's not 100% all the way across the board. We upgraded our firewall this month, which broke the backup restoration process. It is fixed. So when you install a firewall, you normally lock everything down initially, so it breaks everything, and then you start enabling services, and so that was broken for a few days. We're back up and running. The EISAC, we are still reviewing that. We got 60 emails that we reviewed in the month of March. Some interesting stuff. Threat from landowner, possible air rifle damage to substation transformer gauges. We're seeing a lot of theft and stuff at substations. I don't know if that's the trend that's going to be happening that we're going to see locally, so we are keeping an eye on it. And finally, we have completed our payment card industry compliance, PCI compliance. Stephen ran with that, did a great job. So we are compliant for another year.
Yay.
And that concludes my presentation.
What is a payment card?
So any company that takes payments via the credit card has to be compliant with safety features and things that we have to do to protect the card information.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I even had to do it at Sugar's, a little...
You were compliant.
Yeah, but I mean, you still have to file it.
I don't.
They don't just let you go. They send you bills, and then they send you penalties when you don't pay those bills.
Okay, thank you, Scott. Randall?
Yes, I'm ready. All right, first pick there, Stephen, thank you. So this is one of the foundations on the RG number 2 line that Summit's doing for NV Energy, that's near Tortoise Substation. They've recently reached out to us to ask us for a possible outage the first part of May on our 138 line so they can pull over their conductor into the last structure, dead end structure near the sub. And they should be completed sometime middle to the end of May with the project. Next slide. This is AGEC. They're a soils contractor out of St. George. And they're finishing up the drilling for all the foundation locations on our 138 line. And this report is important for us, for the engineers to be able to design the foundation sizes for our steel structures. Next slide.
Now, Randall, are these for like the corners? I thought those were all going to be direct embed.
Well, we have a lot of areas that we don't have guying areas. We have some
along the freeway there.
Along the freeway. We have some transpositions because of the length of the line. We have a couple transpositions in that line, and those require foundations. Okay. So there's going to be about 10 foundations throughout the project. This is Raptor. They finished the gates, so Raptor's enclosed. The block wall's complete. Those are the gates. We are currently waiting for foundation drawings to start that process. The transformer will be here at the end of summer for this substation. Next slide. This is the retaining wall footing. Dale, up in your area for Long Drive switchyard. They'll be blocking that starting this next couple weeks and have that completed. Then we can finish the backfill and start on the upper block wall for the switchyard. Thank you, Stephen. On the 138 line, we finalized the drawings for the 138 line between Raptor and Long Drive. And we'll have those plans at the end of this month. We've ordered all of the long lead items, and then we'll have the final bill of materials for all the small items. That's my report.
So when will the line be completed, though?
For the
Raptor?
Probably end of this year, beginning of next year. There's some of the long lead items. We're not going to have the materials till the end of this year.
Okay. All right. Long lead.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Randall. Corey?
We're good. Our April report for our hookups, we had a total of 48 hookups, 39 residential and 9 commercial. Leaves 156 for the year so far for the first quarter. And then locates, we had 256 locates, 113 inspections, and 376 audits for the month of March. And then outages, we had 13 total outages, 8 of them unplanned and 5 planned. Now, we had quite a bit of outage time with those, with the unplanned outages, the tree, and then we had I'll show a pole fire that we had because of the house fire in Bunkerville that caused a significant time outage, and then additionally we had a long outage on a remote location while we did some work on the line. So we had 2178 hours of outage time per customer, and 857 customers affected. Our AC leaves us at 99.984 for the month of March. So our safety program, we're at 6 years, six months, and 4 days of no lost time accident. Our safety topic was enclosed space, vault rescue, and accident investigation. Now, we had IPSA meetings in March, and Overton Power received a first place safety award for D class, which is 70,000 hours or over with no lost time accident. So that's a great thing.
That's what I say.
Great. great measuring stick. It doesn't want to, we don't want that to be our focus, so that people hide things and don't want to be the one that breaks that, but it is a great measuring stick of where we're at and what our culture's like. So this is the Bunkerville house fire that took place. And because of the fire, it actually caught our pole on fire. And you can see, it actually, with the heat that was generated, it severed the secondary wires coming out of the transformer. And so we ended up replacing that pole.
Does that detemper some of that line? Do you have to replace line ever with those? Or?
Well, we haven't, but it can damage it. Mm-hmm. So this is our Mormon Mesa microwave line. So it feeds a few customers the microwaves and the cell towers FAA out here on the north end of the Mesa. And so we have a couple of rotten poles that were on this line, and so it took significant effort to try and figure out how we were going to rectify and get those, because I think in the day that those were set was probably donkey and blasting and set those poles by hand. And so we contracted that, and they did this with helicopter. They set those poles.
And we own that line, and is that our?
It's ours.
We have to maintain
correct.
That.
Yep. But that's what you do. So this is just a picture of them actually lifting the pole up. And so these are ductile poles we put in, so we shouldn't have to touch them for a while. And we had ladders are on those structures, and that's how they climbed up and did the work, was off of those steel ladders. So that was a good one. Now, you have any questions?
They hand dig those holes, and then the chopper lays the pole in.
So initially, they felt like they could do. It's a quick piece of equipment they call a spider, which is they can crawl over the rocks and it's an excavator, kind of a hybrid backhoe style of a piece of equipment. And when they initially bid that, they were, we can do this with a spider. Well, they got to the first hole, because it even has an auger on it. So auger, bucket, the whole works. And they got to the first hole and found out that they couldn't use the spider. And so they did, they end up flying in some jackhammers, some compressors and jackhammer holes. Yeah. So, any other questions on that? Okay. So this is our safety demonstration trailer at the Clark County Fair. This is the crew that ran that, and grateful for each of them and the work that they did there. They may still be recuperating a little bit from fair food and other things, but so this is a kind of an overall snapshot of the area. We were given the opportunity to participate in the fair and given a spot to do a safety demonstration, and so we took opportunity to do that, and it ended up being a phenomenal experience in my opinion. It's wonderful to see linemen get up and talk about what they do in a safety setting. It wasn't about our safety, but it was about the public safety. And if we save one life, then it's well worth it. And I believe that we did that, and probably even saved some linemen's life as we talked about even generators. And so this is one of the days of presentation. All of the apprentices and the linemen that were on that crew participated in doing presentations. And so that was phenomenal to see a first year apprentice step up and talk about electrical safety. So it was a great experience.
I didn't know we had a flag though.
Yeah,
we do.
And so just some pictures, I have several pictures of the arc, and this was on our safety trailer. We have just a simulated aluminum ladder that we simulate maybe a tool or a ladder getting in the line, someone carrying their ladder across the yard, and the crew did just a bang-up job on reaching the public and doing that.
Cool that you have a fire district right behind you.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the hot dog now.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see the hot dog here, and it's jumping the gap there. And this was Freddy, is the mag, the dummy's name, that gets fried. So. And so that's my report, unless you have any additional questions. One of the takeaways that really was interesting was in the demonstration, we show how a backup generator, if you plug it directly into your house, then we can demonstrate the arc on the line, that it's backfeeding through the transformer and energizing the high voltage lines. And so we're able to demonstrate that with just a 2,000 watt generator, just a small single phase 120 generator. And there were several people that I heard as I was sitting, you know, kind of in the back and sometimes in the stands listening, that with a two male end cord that people could use, you know, they talk about it on YouTube, and we told them why they shouldn't use that cord, that there were several people that I caught their eye. There was like, I made eye contact. you get rid of that. And I know that Kyle had one guy that ended up being from St. George, but that actually said he does that. And so Kyle made him promise that he would get rid of that cord, and he said that he would repurpose it. So we saved someone's life anyway. And that's my report.
Thank you.
Any questions for Corey? Thanks, Corey. Yeah. Shane, you're up. Shane is doing our substation operations report today.
Okay, so during our routine inspections with our infrared program in Bunkerville Substation, we found a couple of hot spots. You can see here and here on the image, they were about 40 degrees warmer than the ambient temperature early in the morning. And so we took that as an opportunity to go and replace those conductors. And this is obviously the before and the after picture. You can see how much cooler those conductors were. Sometimes those connections can get corroded or they have bad crimps and can lead to excessive heating. So this was a good catch that we were able to hopefully prevent an outage. This is just showing, we had removed the jumpers. Those were the connections there that were hot, and then after we had replaced those conductors. Annually we go around and pull oil samples from all our voltage regulators and do dielectric breakdown testing to determine the insulating quality of the oil. So we go out and pull an oil sample from each regulator and bring it back and put it in this machine here on the left. And then the picture on the right is a zoomed in image of the tester. We put the oil in there, and then those two spherical electrodes will put up to 40,000 volts across that and then see the flashover point on the oil to determine the quality of it. So far everything's passed, and we're just about through all of that. In Tortoise Substation, we had a customer call in and reported arcing on a switch. You can see the switch pad here. It had gotten pretty hot, and luckily it didn't cause any kind of power quality or outage issue. So we were able to take our spare switch and get that replaced without issue. That is my report.
Good job, Shane. Thank you. Any questions for Shane? He's dying for you to ask him a question. All right, I've got a couple of things to report for you. First of all, during this month, I have worked on our purchase power agreement, and I've spent a little bit of time on this. In fact, I've probably talked to Nick more than I have my wife this month. So. But we'll have a report on that later. Earlier this month, I went to a CRETA meeting. It was held at Platte River Power Authority in Fort Collins, Colorado. Platte River Power Authority is a member of CRETA, and we had the meetings at their offices. Beautiful facility. I'd never been there before. But during our CRETA meetings, we talked about the federal budget. We had a report from our federal lobbyist, and we talked about the budget and where he thinks that things will go with the budget. And along with that, we talked about the two bills that we're supporting. One is the Save Hoover bill, which is a bill that will release money, stranded funds that, at Hoover, that we can put back into the system to work. There's about $49 million that are stranded there. That bill has a high probability of passing, so we've submitted letters of support to all of our congressional delegation in support of that, and that will move forward. They're working on finding a vehicle that we can get that bill through. Our lobbyist says that there will be very few bills that actually get passed this year that make it through, so they're trying to find a vehicle, probably the farm bill, where we can attach that and get that passed through. In the past, I've talked to you about the Hydro Act. That's another bill that we've supported and issued letters in support of. Although everyone agrees that it's a good bill, I don't think that we have much chance of getting that passed this year because of a couple of reasons. One is the scoring from the budget office, and the other is nobody's willing to attach it to a bill. We have plenty of support, but nobody will go out on a limb to attach it to anything. So we're throwing most of our support in the Save Hoover because we think we can get that pushed through. At our CRETA meeting, the Western Area Power Administration attended the meeting. They gave a report on a number of things, but the thing that we talked about most was the supplemental EIS that's happening. That's the environmental impact statement at Glen Canyon Dam. It's kind of interesting because this SEIS has become very controversial to the point that not only do power companies and the environmentalists who normally disagree with each other, but there's a number of federal agencies that don't agree with what's going on either and are at odds with each other. And we had WAPA and Bureau of Reclamation at our CRETA meeting, and they are at odds over what's going on with this. One of the things that's a big component of this is when the dams were created, that hydropower was listed as one of the priority functions of the dam. And during this SEIS process, a lot of the environmental groups are working to have that statement removed from the documents. So that's something that we're really working on trying to preserve, as well as WAPA is working in that direction. The Bureau of Reclamation talked about a number of things. They talked about snowpack and water levels. You've probably heard that as a follow-up to Aaron's report at the last board meeting, we did actually end up with more than 100% of the annual snowpack. The problem is they, with the last few weeks being dry, they're only predicting about 90 to 95% of annual runoff. So they're worried about the hydrology with the soil. They say that the soil is dried out, and they're worried about wind evaporating some of the runoff. But despite that, they're still predicting that Lake Powell will go up 25 to 50 feet this year, and that keeps us in the mid-elevation tier at both Lake Powell and at Lake Mead. So last year, if you remember, we had really good runoff, and it moved us from the critical tier up to the mid-level tier, and we should stay in that range. So we shouldn't see any additional changes or cutbacks to our hydropower.
I read an article this morning. I don't know how credible it was, but it was saying there's damage at Glen Canyon Dam, and that they may have to, which means they may not let water flow through it, which means no power from Glen Canyon and no water to Lake Mead. While they get that fixed, and it may take substantial time or something like that. What you heard?
That was a very good lead-in, Byron, because that was my next topic.
Sorry.
That's perfect. I love it when you give me a good lead-in. So we did talk about that. One of the things that we're concerned about that's part of the SEIS are these high-flow experiments that they do at Glen Canyon Dam. The high-flow experiments are intended to put water through the bypass tubes instead of running them through the turbines. And the whole purpose of that is to put sand on the beaches for campers to keep the silt moving through the dam. So when they've done those high-flow experiments, the Bureau of Reclamation said that they've seen minor damage inside those bypass tubes. It's the bypass. And these tubes are coated with, there's actually steel pipes inside there, and they said that they've started to see some damage to those steel pipes. So, yes, it's a concern. It's not anything that they feel that there's an imminent danger. It's something that they need to address, but it has nothing to do with generating hydropower. And, in fact, if it did come to the point that they didn't do the high-flow experiments and ran everything through the turbines, we would be happy with that. And if that's what they're forced to do, we would love that. So that's what we're hoping for. But very minor damage, doesn't affect any of the hydropower plant operations. Anything else you... I read that story too, and I go, this is a little bit...
It was doomsday, Avalon.
Yeah. Wasn't quite accurate. I also attended a PUCN workshop. The PUCN, as you remember... The last legislative session, our legislature required the state, the PUCN, to have a market in Nevada in place by 2030. And so the PUCN held a meeting with NV Energy during this last week. And it's kind of an interesting meeting because, first of all, they only focused on NV Energy. That seems to be their entire focus. It's not on any of the rural electrics. And NV Energy's response is they seem to be primarily looking at the CAISO day-ahead market as their means of meeting this regulation. So we'll see how that goes. That's only one meeting. We've got six more years to go with a lot more meetings, but that's the way it's progressing at this point. We attended the Colorado River Commission meeting, Melissa and Jonathan and I. Bob Reese retired from... is actually retiring next week from the Colorado River Commission. He is over there substation operations, and we've had a great relationship with Bob Reese. And he's actually shared some of his testers, some of his manpower with us. And so we're sad to see him go, but we went and to the meeting and expressed our gratitude to him. And we'll miss him, but we also got to meet his replacement. It's a gentleman that's worked at Burns McDonald out of Kansas City for a number of years. He's been working on behalf of Burns McDonald at Colorado River Commission for the past few years, so it should be a pretty seamless transition. So we'll try and keep a good relationship with them. And I continue to work with Colorado River Commission to work for a joint action agency. We're going to talk about that at our next NREA meeting. I've also been working with the county commissioner on a Moapa overlay for rural development. In fact, Judy sat in on that meeting as well. I guess I sat in with you and Marilyn is the way that it went. And the water district and the fire department and some representatives from Moapa sat in on that meeting. I don't know that we heard concerns. We didn't come to really any conclusions at this point, did we? So I'm sure there will be some more discussions, some more meetings. Finally, our NRECA legislative conference is coming up, and we have meetings set up to meet with the federal agencies in Washington, D.C., and we also have meetings set up to meet with each of our legislators. And the three things that we're going to prioritize when we talk to them is renewables, hydropower, and reliability. Now, one of the interesting things NRECA scheduled this in a year in advance. The legislators have chosen to take recess during this time. So we don't get to meet with the actual legislators this go-round, but in some ways that's good because we have the full attention of their staff, and it gives us a little bit more opportunity and a little more time to meet with them. So all is not lost. It actually turns into a little better thing because these policy folks on their staff are the ones that give the ideas back to the legislators. So once in a while, it's a good thing to have that, and we'll have that this time. And that's my report, unless you have any questions for me.
I heard the staff writes all the bills anyway.
A lot of times, contractors and staff do write the bills, and then they just take them in there and mark them up. So, yeah, that's...
But there was a, you know, I've read some things recently about the overall grid for the country really needs huge upgrades. Not reliability, upgrades. Was there any discussion about anything like that? Because that's going to be an expensive operation and take years and years, I think.
So you guys from Tenasca might have some input on that, but from the talks that I've been in, yes, there are some upgrades that need to happen. There's a couple of concerns. One is the grid was designed for a certain level, and we've outgrown that in some areas. Another problem is a lot of the renewable projects are placed in areas where maybe the transmission system isn't adequate to move it to the loads, and we've seen a lot of growth in a lot of areas, and we haven't kept up with that because of permitting issues. And that's something that we continue to talk to our legislators about besides that. Anything you guys would add to that?
No, I think those are the primary points that I would concur with. The grid's growing quickly. The renewables themselves stress the grid in a different way than the traditional thermal units have, and where they're located, it requires heavy investment to move that power to load centers. And so all of that is just expensive.
Yep.
One of my pet peeves, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like to me when we've gone to these markets that it takes a lot of maintenance and upgrade responsibilities away from the utilities and assigns them to nobody. And we seem to get a little bit behind. Do you kind of have that same feeling?
Yes, it's a more broad schedule, and the allocation of projects for major upgrades, there's more jockeying for, you know, because they don't want to just upload a bunch of costs to customers all at once. And so in doing that, the planning and is more backlogged. I would say there's more challenges versus the more regional ownership of the whole process. Yes.
Okay.
So like an example in Texas, there has been so much renewables down in the San Antonio area. Just on the west side, kind of, let's say west side, between San Antonio and Laredo, that the ERCOT market did not plan for the type of build-out in that area from both customer people moving and businesses moving into San Antonio, and then the renewable projects themselves being built. And as such, it's created such constraints that now they need, you know, 2 years to resolve, but they're... The cascading effect from a fault on this specific transmission path and what it could do to the neighboring transmission lines and react is made its way to the governor, you know, concern. So, and that was just due to the fact that the planning process just missed. They missed the low growth and they missed the amount of renewable interest in the space, and it's causing, a number of other projects to get and push back so everyone can focus on this.
I think we see that very thing happen in California a lot, too.
Yeah.
I would like to see on the meet with legislature all of the things that we have to do to upgrade security at our substations, if there's any financial help out there for any of those things, because it's a large added expense, and because of our locations, we have high vulnerability. I drove by the Bunkerville station when they were working, and it was later in the day, and I thought to myself, should I call Mendez and make sure people were supposed to be out there, because I couldn't see if the trucks had the emblem or not. And it just came to me that, you know, one like this one over here off Bunkerville, there's normally, I mean, when you drive that road, you rarely see cars. And it would be nice if through the government we could get some aid in, some kind of grant that helps with the security.
That would be really nice. Let me tell you a funny story about that.
There's nothing funny about that.
For the next 4 years, the government has allocated $5 million per year for rural development projects, including security.
$5 million.
To all. To spread them out.
So we submitted an application for that to the governor's Office of Energy. And last week, Carolyn from Nevada Rural Electric told us that all of our applications had been denied because they were going to give the money to Nevada Power to do work in their rural areas. So
give them to the one that has all the money.
That's right. That's right.
That seems fair.
So we continue to work on that, but that's kind of the stuff that we're running into.
Oh my gosh, Rich.
You know, that's an idea.
Maybe on that note, let's go to the financial report.
Let's get started.
That was through the state, though, that you had asked
for? That was administered by the governor's Office of Energy.
For the only profit-making one, they get the money.
Yeah, yeah.
Nonprofits, tough.
Okay. From our statement of operations for March, our operating revenue was $3,380,000. On line number three, you can see that our cost of purchased power was $1,886,000. That contributed to our total cost of electric service on line number 20 of $3,283,000. On line 22, you can see that for interest received on investments was $135,000 for the month. That gave us a margin for March of $229,685.
Question about the month before that, we made 230, and the month before that, it was almost 400,000.
So,
is that right?
No.
Oh.
sorry. I really close. How about that? So the far column D on the far right is what we received for the month.
Yes.
Column C, just to the left of that, is what we budgeted.
Gotcha.
And column B is what we've received for the year. So the $135,650 that we received in March contributed to, we've totaled so far this year, $397,000 in interest that we've received.
Okay. So it's much more cumulative than it is individual month, only the last number.
Yes.
It's the month.
The far right is the month.
Cumulative from the beginning of the
year.
Yep.
It's this year to date.
I was close.
You were so close.
Sorry.
You had the numbers right, just not in the right order.
Yeah, thank you.
So if you look at column A, you can see on line number 22 that in March of 2023, we had received $222,000 in interest. And in March of 2024, we've received $397,000 in interest. On the asset side of our balance sheet, our total utility plant in service value is at now $169 million. We have investments in associated organizations, cash, investments, materials, and other deferred debits, giving us a total asset value of $176 million. On the liability side, you can see that our total margins and equities is now at $117 million. We have long-term debt, accounts payable, and other deferred credits, giving us, again, that total liability value of $176 million. Here is a breakdown of our cash. We had a net increase from the prior month of $4.2 million. We did move some money from Goldman to cover some of those bills. To the right of each of those accounts, anything that is interest-bearing, I gave you a breakdown of how much each one of those brought in. So if you look at the bottom of the page, you can see that our Morton investments brought in $359,868, and our Goldman Sachs, it brought in $36,000.
That's for this month?
Uh-huh.
Not cumulative?
That's cumulative for the year. That's everything for the year these investments have brought
in. Year-to-date.
So we'll keep building that up so that you see which accounts are paying at what. This is a breakdown of those Morton investments by security type and the duration of those investments. As we've talked about with our planning, we've moved some of those from the short term over to a little bit longer term. those longer terms are still paying at over 4%. So we're ensuring that we have stability going out into the future should there be a recession or a decline in those rates. This is just a breakdown of those investments. I know it's hard to see on the screen, but I like to put it out there so that you guys can see our total average for the Morton investments return is at 4.3%. But I sorted this by the purchase yield. And if we look here, you can see how many of those we've locked at 6% and 5% going up. We finished the month with 18,411 customers. We have a modified debt service coverage with estimates through the end of the year of 2.43. Equity as a percentage of assets is at 66.64%, and our TIER is at 7.24%. One of the things that we have discussed is doing a quarterly review, or as we see changes that are going to be need to made in our pro forma for rates going forward as we look at new power costs. And so while I don't have an update because our pro forma hasn't changed as of yet, one of the things that I thought would be good is to give you a little bit of detail on what makes up these three things: modified debt service coverage, equity as a percentage of assets, and TIER, so that as we go forward in our rate setting, you understand what we use in our strategies for setting those rates. So I know this is a little bit boring, but Jack's not here to complain, so I'm just going to read to you just what these three things are quickly. So modified debt service coverage is the measurement of a system's ability to generate sufficient operating funds to cover its cash requirements, but it's adjusted to eliminate non-cash amounts that are included in margins, such as capital credits that are received by OPD5 from cooperatives like NRU CFC, Meridian, or Federated, as well as depreciation, all of our non-cash adjustments. A ratio of 1 would indicate that the district is generating only enough cash to cover its principal and interest payments on its long-term debt. Now, the median by size is from the KRTA from last year. We've just submitted all of those financials. We're due by April 15th. And so we've submitted those, and we'll be getting those new KRTAs in a few months. And so we will use those new numbers to set those strategies going forward. If you remember, on our modified debt service coverage, we're required to have 1.35, and that's the average of 3 years. It's actually the average of your two highest of the last 3 years. Equity level as a percentage of assets measures the extent to which the district's consumers have financed plant and other assets with their own funds, as distinguished from assets that were financed with borrowed capital. A high equity rate is an indication that the district has financed plant additions primarily with internally generated funds over the years. A low ratio could indicate that the district has utilized long-term debt capital to finance most of its plant additions and replacements. Now, on equity as a percentage of assets, we're at 66.64 currently. We must maintain 39.5 to qualify for our discounts that we receive from NRU CFC on all of our long-term debt. And then TIER is the times interest earns measures the district's ability to earn margins sufficient to cover the interest expense on long-term debt. TIER is a primary indicator of a utility's financial health to lending institutions. A TIER of 1.0 indicates a system with no margins left for financing of new projects. Now, TIER is a measuring tool that is used for all our U.S. borrowers and many commercial bank borrowers. NRU CFC does not use TIER. They use modified debt service coverage, but it's one of the things that we use to set our strategies because we know our peers are judged on TIER, and it is something that when we do our Fitch rating that they do look at. So it's something that I put for you guys to keep track of as well. And again, we set strategies based on that.
Back to TIER.
Yes.
I see it says here, the district's ability to earn margins. Does that mean we have the ability to raise rates? Or so, that's what it means, doesn't it?
Yes.
Basically, okay, yeah.
Yes. But the measurement of TIER, not everybody has, well, I'll say different entities have different abilities in setting their rates or where they set their rates.
PUC.
But this is just saying, if you come in only at one, that you're only bringing in enough margins to just pay your interest on your long-term debt.
Dangerous, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. We received 78 connect fees for $40,731. We currently have 33 billing arrangements, and our Roundup program is going strong in both valleys. Here is a breakdown of our long-term debt, and you guys, we're below $50 million. You see, $49.6 million. Corey got some claps. I feel like we should get some claps for being under $50 million. I'm just saying. Thank you from the Peanut Gallery, my two accounting people over there.
Well, one of the reasons we're excited about that is you remember when we took out the loans 2 years ago, we promised you that we would be able to maintain our equity our equity percentage and get the debt back down to where it needed to be, and we're right on track to meet our goals there. So we're excited about that.
Yeah, we are too.
Yeah. Not as excited as we are.
Not as excited as me, but yeah. Here is a breakdown of our revenue by customer class. If you look at the bottom of the page, you can see that our monthly cost of power was at 6 cents, our monthly revenue was at 11, and our 2024 average cost is at 5.6. And that concludes my presentation, unless you have questions.
Why so much higher?
I think there's a couple of things. First off, this is an estimate. We estimated EIM. We had larger EIM charges and bandwidth charges at this time last year. So using those numbers, they estimated a little bit high. I do think when we get actuals that you're going to see that dropped just a little bit. But we have new folks that are estimating, and I tell them when in doubt, be safe and do it a little bit higher than lower. I know that comes as a surprise to you, Chad. And that concludes my presentation, unless you guys have more questions for me.
Does anybody have other questions? We're all good? Okay. Item H, review and possible acceptance of the annual audit report by Hafen, Buckner, Everett, and Graff for possible action. Have
that? Yes. So, as you guys know, this is Jolene's last year of working with our auditor and preparing our financial statements. And she has been busy training both Jonathan and Kim. And we have Jonathan and Kim both here today to answer any questions. And just like Shane, they're dying for you to ask them a question. So, from Hafen Buckner, Everett and Graff, we have Nate Vibey is here to do the presentation. And in front of you guys, you should each have a bound copy of our audit report for review. And so I'll turn it over to Nate.
Awesome. Thank you. Kevin Jones, who performed the audit, would like to have been here. He had a family conflict and sent someone else down to take care of that for you. First off, he wanted me to express appreciation for your trust in us and allowing us to help you with the audit this year. This covers the year-end 2022 and 2023 fiscal years, calendar years. As far as the audit, the opinion of the audit is we have audited the accompanying balance, basic financial statements of Orkin Power, and as of the year ended December 31st, 2023 and 2022. In our opinions, the financial statements referred to above present fairly, in all material respects, the financial position of Overton Power District, number 5, as of December 31st, 2022 and 2023. And the results of its operations and cash flows for the year then ended in accordance with accounting principles generally accepted in the United States of America. Kevin, when I was discussing the audit with him, also wanted me to express this is one of his favorite audits to work on. Because of the management team you have, it's one of the cleanest. The response times are short. He's able to get through it in an efficient manner. And he appreciates you and also wants to let you know how good your team is. They really do a good job in keeping things as you noted in their financial reports, keeping things in line, reporting back, and making sure that they're following the accounting standards required. As part of the audit, it is also required that we present a few items of significant findings as part of the checklist for the audits. So, qualitative, this is on the very back. There's a separate note sheet or report that comes out. This is coming straight from that. So, as far as responsibilities, management is responsible for the selection and use of appropriate accounting policies. No new accounting policies were adopted, and the application of existing policies has not changed during the year 2023. And as in note one outlines those policies, should you need a refresher on them. going down a little further, the most sensitive estimates affecting the district's financial statements were management's estimate of the allowance for doubtful accounts. And it's based on the district's past experience and its ability to collect amounts due. Difficulty encountered in performing the audit. There were no significant difficulties noted. Corrected and uncorrected misstatements. Essentially, management has corrected all misstatements that may have been found. If you need questions or details on any that may have been found, speak with your management team, and they can also reach out. You can reach out to Kevin, and he can provide any additional details. But as far as I'm aware, there were anything significant that needed to be presented to you. Management representations and management consultations with other independent accountants, and to our knowledge, there were no such consultations with any other accountants. Are there any questions or anything else I can go over with you as part of the audit?
Yeah, I do. Not surprising. Page 21, notes to financial statement. Very top. Inflation rate, 2.5. How did that work? I mean, somehow the news seems to have quite a bit higher than the federal government stated the very top at a page. And then investment rate of return right below it, 7.25. Not up to snuff here. And then projected salary increases.
Can I answer that, Nate?
Yes, please. You
have okay, great. Information on that. So this note, if you go back to, let me see what page it starts on 19, you see that the beginning of this note is discussing PERS and what Overton Power, what percentage we paid in.
No, then, I'm sorry,
page 19.
On fire? PERS.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So this is a discussion on our PERS, our retirement.
Okay.
If you go to the very bottom of the page, it talks about the pension liability, pension expense, and deferred outflows and resources of deferred inflows of resources related to pension.
Yes.
From that point south of that is information that comes from the actuaries that PERS is required to hire as they come in and do an analysis of the underfunding of the PERS retirement balance. So they have an actuary that comes in and says, if we had this inflationary rate, if we had this increase in wages, and if everybody lived to this specific age, and every single person retired at once, how much would PERS be underfunded? And then they take that total underfunding and say, Overton Power, you have this portion of that expense. So all of this information did not come from the OPD staff or the Haith and Buckner staff. This is from the PERS audit that's handled every year that their actuaries, that's the information that they used.
They paid their actuaries for that?
Yes, sir.
13.5%
and 7? Yes. Wow. Yes. So then they GASB, the government Accounting Standards Board came forward and said, well, it actually went to the legislature and they said, you're required to report a portion of the underfunding of this state retirement on your financials. And so all of this comes from those.
It just jumped out as obviously incorrect, just in my opinion. I'm not an auditor.
Is it based on an annual? Is it based on a 10-year period? It doesn't tell us what it's based on.
No.
It doesn't have... structure.
So I would say it's probably been 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I called PERS and said, I want to visit about this. It's confusing. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
And some of these numbers don't really jive. And they said, we're not allowed to talk to you. Have your auditor call us. Okay. And, you know, Kevin was like, oh, great. Yay. You know, but. So.
It's a different world. Then.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it just seems to me from the way that we view this, it seems to be kind of a rolling number, kind of an average number is what we're at least my impression.
But so they go through and take all of these things that essentially say, we believe at the time of retirement, you're going to make this much money and you're going to live to this age after retirement. And then if every single person left the system, how underfunded would it be? Well, then you have a liability for your portion of that underfunding.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So Nate, would you please just go through the management discussion and analysis is just the short highlight of our report, and then if there is any questions, we can point them back to the... So that will start on page 3, please, Stephen.
Page 3,
if we could just go through that, this is the summarization of the final pages, and then if there's something in here that jumps out to you, we can go to that statement and talk about it.
Are there any specific points you want me to bring over? Just kind of read down through it.
Just go through it a little bit.
Looking at the financial highlights, net utility plant increased by $10,593,033 in 2023, and increased by $14,408,998 during 2022. Net assets increased by $16,916,000 in 2023 and $14,132,000 in 2022. Net contributions in aid of construction totaled $1,156,000 in 2023 and $2,220,000 in 2022. Principal long-term debt repayments totaled $3,820,000 in 2023 and $3,507,000 during 2022. A measured approach to borrowing for future capital projects continues to be followed, ensuring timing of needs and interest markets were advantageous to the district as a whole while contributing to meeting all coverage metrics. Overview of financial statements. The discussion analysis is intended to serve as an introduction to the basic financial statements. These basic statements are comprised of two primary components, financial statements and two notes of the financial statements. As noted in the auditor's report, management is responsible for financial statements. The auditors are responsible for ensuring that management complies with governing standards in the United States of America. It's kind of long for that. Do you want me to go down through the
whole thing? No, I think we could just talk about our net assets,
okay,
and then just touch on the net utility plant and see if we have any questions or concerns.
It's pretty similar. Net assets may serve over time as a useful indicator of an entity's financial position. In the case of the district, assets exceeded liabilities by $109.1 million at the close of the fiscal year 2023. It represents an increase from the prior year figure of $12.9 million. The district's net assets in 2023 totaled $180,952,480. Total liabilities, $71,826,633, for total net assets of $109,125,847. Total change in net assets, at the bottom of page 4, $11,760,219. Top of page 5, net utility plant. The highlight Kevin wanted to bring out was the distribution plant. Total $99,315,935. And again, the total $119,458,251. So that's a change of $7,847,778.
Page 5.
Yeah, this is under net utility at the top of page 5. Long-term debt at this point, I like the point now, $49 million. It's at the end of the year, it was $50,579,000. In debt.
And I would just like to say that Jonathan wrote the entire management discussion and analysis statement for me, and I was thinking like, oh, this is going to be a great teaching opportunity. He's going to have some questions, and I'm going to get to work through some things with him. And in fact, all he really did was show me that there were a couple of typos in last year's and some. So, you know, whatever, Jonathan. he did a really, really good job, and he's done a really good job at bringing Kim into the fold, and she's gotten a good understanding of this. So it's been a very positive process for us. Do we have any other questions for Nate?
To be honest, I had a question, but I can't find it.
Okay. Well, then you can call me tomorrow.
Okay.
How about that?
Well, I move that we accept the annual audit report from Nathan Buckover and Graff as presented.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept the financial report. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
One comment might happen is that it would be really nice if we could get this before the board meeting. It was hard reading all the pages.
You want the hard copy of it instead of
yeah. Or just send us email, you know, put it in online so we can look it over because obviously we can't.
It was attached to item H on the website and in your email. It should have been.
Mm-hmm. I didn't see that.
It was.
I saw the agenda.
Okay. It was an attachment.
It was there?
Yeah.
My mistake. Thank you for including it early.
That was what I meant to say. That was a politically correct one.
Go back.
Thank you very much, Nate.
Thank you, Nate.
Thank you.
Okay. Here we go. Item I, review and possible approval of new purchase power agreement for possible action.
Okay, well, we're going to have a multi-layered discussion here. We're going to break this up into some different parts. First of all, I want to recognize our two guests here with us. We have Curry Aldridge from Tenasca. Now, I was talking to Curry before, and I met Curry about 10 years ago, and when he first came, he brought a man named Kerry with him. And I could never keep Curry and Kerry straight, so I've got it now. So we appreciate Curry being here. And then we have Nick Gilmore, who's worked very closely with me on our account, and they are going to give us an overview about Tenasca, about their business and the things that they do. After they get done with that, Byron and I have been through the contracts, and we've talked with through this a lot with Nick. And so Byron and I will go through the contracts with you. And then once we get done with that, we'll talk a little bit about pricing and then see, you know, how we want to proceed from here. So, Stephen, if you would you pull up the Tenasca PowerPoint? You still want that pulled up, right?
Yeah.
And we'll turn a minute to you guys to, and you can stand there, here, wherever you feel comfortable.
Down is to advance.
All right.
Good afternoon. My name is Curry Aldridge. I'm Kerry. I'm Senior Vice President at Tenasca Power Services, and I'm responsible for the origination team and commercial operations. I've been with Tenasca just a little over 24 years, so a pretty good run with the company. This is Nick Gilmore. He's the Director of Origination, specifically focused on the Western U.S. So we have three originators that cover the Western U.S. Nick looks primarily at the Desert Southwest and Rocky Mountains. I have Kerry Morris, who joined me in the meeting with Mendes 10 years ago. He covers California. And then a gentleman named Andrew Heinley covers the Pacific Northwest. And then we have originators that cover the rest of the United States, but that's the team for the West. So I'm going to give you an overview of Tenasca, just as from the corporate standpoint, and then Tenasca Power Services, the team Nick and I are with. So Tenasca Energy is a private company. It's headquartered in Omaha, Nebraska. It was founded in 1987 as an independent power producer. So its focus was building natural gas generation, first cogeneration facilities that would sell steam to a host company that was close proximity to the asset. And then they moved up into combined cycle facilities that range from anywhere from 500 to 900 megawatts, to give you an idea. And so they built a number of those across certain parts of the country, primarily Texas. They developed plants that actually had a dual grid nature. I don't know how familiar you are with the ERCOT market, that it's its own interconnection region, and then the eastern interconnection region. And they built three power plants that sit on the border that can toggle between both They actually can take a turbine down, synchronize to the other grid, and bring it up. And so that was revolutionary at the time, because they could move power between those two completely independent markets. And all of Tenaska is a very risk-averse company, and so its focus has been contracting those assets. So everything they built, they had a long-term power purchase agreement associated with those. So that was the core focus of the company. To do that, and in the event that one of those off-takers, those power purchase agreements, defaulted, they didn't want a power plant just sitting idle. So they created a gas company, Tenaska Marketing Ventures, and a power company, Tenaska Power Services. And they did that at different times. TMV was created in 1992, and TPS was created in 1997. So the idea was, you know, TPS, go get papered with all the entities, the load servers, the utilities, and the markets where our plants reside. In the event this were to happen, in the meantime, figure out a way to make an existence for yourself. And so Tenaska's never had a default on any of their power plants, and they've developed plants throughout the U.S., which I'll touch on in a second. But the marketing companies, Tenaska Marketing Ventures and Tenaska Power Services, have really grown and have become a core portion of the company. And so today, these are the four primary business lines of the company: the power marketing, the gas marketing, project development. They still look to build power plants, and then the asset operations, managing those power plants. So that's the four primary focuses. So last year, and gross operating revenue was just over $25 billion for the company, and has a strong balance sheet. And like I said, it's a private company, but has fully audited financials for those interested. Here's a map of kind of the regions of where Tenaska's assets reside. The primary focus of the company was natural gas generation. They own many of those natural gas plants still, probably around 7,000 megawatts in total of Tenaska-owned assets. They develop, they're developing a lot of renewable, primarily solar in the Midwest, so kind of Illinois, Indiana, Ohio area. They're developing solar projects there, and then battery projects in California markets, a large utility scale. They will not own those. They're developing. Someone else is bringing the equity to ultimately own the asset, but Tenaska develops it. So the company is still a very active participant in the space. And give you an idea, Tenaska has around 800 employees as a total. Most of those are located in Omaha. Nick and I, on the whole power marketing team, are in Dallas-Fort Worth and Irving, Texas, to be specific. And so Tenaska Power Services, just some information about us. We were established in 1997. We're a FERC certified power marketing company. We're a subsidiary of Tenaska Energy. The core focus of our business has been providing what we call energy management services. So providing third-party services to generation owners that are not Tenaska and to load entities that we don't own, but that need our type of work, which I'll talk to space on here in a second. And feel free to ask questions at any time. It's an open discussion. So, and now storage management with large utility scale batteries. That's becoming more and more of a thing, especially in Texas and California. So key departments in our company, so like I said, energy management, there's 250 of us in Irving, so we have a pretty large team. Energy management, they're responsible for talking with customers, helping manage the day-to-day interactions between the various markets. All these markets have different rules and timelines, and so the energy managers work with the customers and the assets in those markets. We have a trading a group that helps move power, both financial and physical, across different markets for different customers. Associated with that comes a lot of credit-related activity. We have a market and risk team that's becoming, these markets are becoming inherently a little more volatile, just the nature of the supply stack that's going to meet them and the way the grid's being kind of shaped by the various legislatures. And then the back office settlements and the reporting around that. It's, these markets are becoming more, I'd say, data intensive, and so the management of that is you know, requires a full-time focus. Our type of customers, some municipal cooperatives and water authorities. So the very first customer that Tenaska Power Services ever ever signed up was the Public Utility Board of Brownsville, Texas, a municipal utility right in the far south portion of Texas. They're still a customer today. So we signed Brownsville in 1997, and so that was really the first megawatts that TPS ever moved was for Brownsville, and they're still a customer today. Renewable and storage developers, it's a huge business for us. We probably have inbounds of 4 to 5 a week across the country of different solar projects, wind projects, storage projects, wanting, you know, our type of support and help. And so we don't close all of those deals, or many of those projects don't get built, but the interest is definitely there. Private equity, the IOUs began to offload generation markets where they couldn't rate base anymore. The private equity space began to acquire those, and that became a customer segment for us. IOUs, we work with a number of big IOUs handling their 24-hour operations or various scheduling functions, especially out east. That's becoming a bigger thing where the IOUs are outsourcing to us because they're like, you have the infrastructure and you're probably more efficient than we are, so we've been doing that. Independent power producers like Tenasca, we would, you know, Tenasca is a customer. We have many partners on the project, so they have to bid the work out, but we work with them. The commercial and industrial sector, we have there's certain areas within the country that are heavy, heavy CNI, like the Houston Ship Channel, for example. If you ever go down there and get an idea, there's a tremendous amount of power consumption, gas consumption, so we work with a number of those big users. Community choice aggregators, they're really a growing presence in California, and so that's been a big customer base for us in selling them RA and RPS products, carbon-free products, and then retail suppliers. We work with a number of retail suppliers throughout the United States for wholesale power. So we have multiple 24-hour shifts. So we have our operations there in Irving, we have 7x24 operations. We have 6 rotations of 24-hour desks. So 3 are focused on operations, handling assets to ISO or transmission provider type communications. 2 are focused on scheduling and transaction business there in the real time. And then 1 is focused on real time energy management. And their pure focus is on quick start gas peakers and energy storage, because those can be optimized in real time. And then we have, with about 4 miles from our primary, a fully redundant backup site that can withstand a category 4 or F4 tornado. That never occurs, but also has plenty of room for the full operations. I'm going to let Nick talk about a couple of slides here, just our presence specifically in Nevada and kind of what we're doing in the West.
Yeah, so Nick Gilmore again. I lead our origination efforts in the West for the Rocky Mountains and in the desert Southwest. Been at Tenasca 10 years this summer. So you can see here, Nevada right here has a pretty big bubble on it. It's where most of my customers are and where I probably spend the most time outside of Dallas. I was here probably every single month in 2023 and third time out here this year. So spend a lot of time in the state. We're very plugged in the state here. Manage a lot of load customers already in southern and northern Nevada, and also have a few power generation customers that we manage in Nevada.
The button down button.
That's what I did.
Stephen.
There we go. So hitting on Nevada a bit more. So we began serving load in the state in 2016. I'm sure you read about a lot of the large customers that exited NV Energy system. So that's the bulk of the customers we have there. I think we have 11 of the 13 customers that have left their system that are under our management. That totals up to about 400 megawatts of load. In addition to that, we also, some other things that are good synergies for us in Overton Power District are, we've also worked with the Colorado River Commission. We've managed some of their hydro for one of their other customers since 2017, so have a good relationship with them and optimizing Parker Davis and Hoover Dams, which you guys have allocations of as well. And another thing to hit on too, since I know you all have entered into a solar PPA, one of our Nevada customers in Southern Nevada does have solar as well. So all those are new, not new things, managing solar and hydro in Southern Nevada. So I think that experience would go a long way managing Overton's load and portfolio. And then just hitting on the generation side of things. So we in the Desert Southwest, we really manage all technology types, whether it's generators that we're representing at third-party owners or that we have positions off of ourselves. But we have, there's gas, coal, hydro, nuclear, geothermal across all the Desert Southwest states, including some in Nevada. And then just hit on that, we have extensive experience working with ND Energy, working with their marketing side and their transmission side. We know their transmission system very well, so we can, you know, pull things from Northern Nevada, Southern Nevada, different locations to get to your location at Mead, the Mead Trading Hub. We've had a really good working relationship with them. Obviously, all of our customers are still ND Energy customers as well, right? They take transmission and distribution service from them, so we've worked alongside them for the past 8 years.
Any questions about Tenasca or TPS specific?
So you talked about your control center. You have a control center there in Irving, and you said 4 miles away. Do you have any others? Do you have like a redundant control center in Omaha or anything like that?
So we can operate from there. We do routine failovers from a IT technical, so we can run and support all of our systems from Omaha separately, which is good to have. We have backup generation. We have a building generator and then our own generator at our primary site in Irving. We have a backup generator at our redundant site, and then the site in Omaha is completely separate, you know, electric grid, and it has its own backup generation as well. So, yeah, if all things fail, so like during Winter Storm Uri in February 2021, we managed through everything, even though, because the rolling blackouts were happening all throughout the state. We never lost power. Our generator, our building got hit, but our generators maintained. And since then, the local transmission provider, the Longport, has registered our building as a critical infrastructure. And so it's precluded from rolling blackouts.
Nice. So that's where our loads and transmission, everything will be managed from those locations, or primarily from the one location.
Yes.
In those 24-hour centers.
That's right. So we'll schedule on a daily basis all the transactions from wherever we're supplying the energy, handling the CRC allocation, and then the energy management team on a daily basis will hand that off to the 24-hour team. And so all that scheduling functions there in Irving, Texas.
I don't know if this is the best time to ask, but do we have all the SCADA, all the stuff in place that you guys would need to manage us?
That would be something we do after, right, if we execute the contracts that we, and there's plenty of time to get that in place before January 1, but yeah, we get that all in place, and so we're getting real-time feeds of the load data and scheduling appropriately.
They just need the Taurus meter data, basically.
And so one of the things I think maybe wasn't mentioned on the slide, we have a whole new customer implementation team. So once we have a new customer contract signed, we work with them to get any of that communication set up, make sure we have the appropriate data feeds and all that. So that'd be part of the onboarding process.
So they coordinate with, I believe you get a meter read from Mead and then one from NV Energy at Reed Gardner. But they also coordinate and work with Colorado River Commission on our hydro, and they will also work with our solar provider to manage all of those simultaneously. If the solar project gets finished.
Stop that. It's going to.
You're making a mess out
there. So all of those sources have a different cost. So what's their incentive to keep us on the least expensive?
That's a good question. What's your incentive to maximize our hydro and solar to ensure that we're getting those low-cost is a part of our portfolio.
Yeah, no, because we have a set amount, right? We know what your load forecasts are going forward. And we have certain things in our agreement, right, that we're bound to following and using those resources. So we're incented to maximize that hydro as well, right? If we're not scheduling the solar hydro, you know, we're not, one, following our duty under the contract to be doing so. But two, then we'd be needing to supply more market power, right? Those are low-cost contracts that you have, hydro and solar, right? Much lower than the market right now. So I think our incentives are all aligned to maximize that, your contracts.
So just to add a little color to that, Morgan Stanley's done a really good job for us managing those things. And as I've talked to Nick about, you know, those specifics, for example, when there's layoffs of hydro and we can take extra hydro, right now Morgan Stanley looks at our bandwidths and they see if we can fit in some extra hydro. And Nick is committed to do all of those things, just like Morgan Stanley's been doing for us. So we shouldn't lose any of our service capability that we're getting now.
And the other thing I would add is, you know, we view you as a long-term partner, right? So if we're entering into a three-year partnership, we want you to be happy with the service and the relationship and partnership that you receive with us. And so we don't just look at it as a one-time agreement. Hopefully, you know, 3 years from now, we're looking and talking about another longer-term agreement with you all. So by gaining the trust, right, and showing that we're in it together is all part of that, right?
Okay, we ready to talk through some contracts?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, and don't you guys aren't off the hook as we go along. Yeah. You know, we'll ask you to chime in.
Negotiating power, right?
So, Stephen, that's the errata. Open up the master purchase power agreement. Okay. So let me explain this for you to make this easier. So there's this master power purchase and sell agreement. This is done by the Edison Electric Institute, and this is a industry standard contract. And so we had the same contract with Morgan Stanley. Tenasca uses the same contract. So you take this contract as the base for all of our discussions. On about page 3 or 4, just after the table of contents, there's what's called the cover sheet. We're going to talk about that in a minute because that has a lot of detail in it. But we take this. There was the errata that Stephen just showed.
Let him look at the name of all of those agreements.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's easier.
Yeah, so there's the errata. That is... additional changes to this agreement, so that all refers back to this. And then you have the opportunity to go to the cover sheet. Let's start there. So the cover sheet is one place where we'll find a lot of details. And go, Stephen, you're in the master. Let's find the cover sheet. Yeah, that one.
Oh, I was in the right spot.
That's the right one. So we've gone through here and entered our data. Now, I gave these to Byron to go through, and Byron had some suggestions for us. Do you want to go through those, or do you want me to go through them?
Just, and I don't know if you guys took the time to look through them, hopefully you did. It's a situation where you have to sit down one contract, the next one, kind of like I've got it right here, and go through them. Because they don't make sense without all of them together. And you just go through, and as you go through and look and make sure that what erratas, covers, all that applies to OPD. And so as I went through it, I looked for things that red flagged me, for me, and I sent them to him, who sent them to him. And it looks like we've worked through pretty much the agreement and God, I don't know if you want to see my concerns because they've been fixed in the final agreement, but so they don't really apply.
So Stephen, let's go to the next page, and This was one of Byron's concerns is if you go down to Article 5 and you see the check in Party B, that was the default amount. Do you want to talk about your concerns there, Byron?
Yeah, it was $100 million, and I didn't see us... And what that means is if we default and they get to go collect, basically, against us... they could pay the default amount, the most, was $100 million. Well, our contract's not even for $100 million. So it didn't make sense that we could be liable up to $100 million. And so they agreed to remove that down to $50 million just to make me feel better. But,
and me feel better,
too. And her feel better. Things like that.
As right
this
down
is
the road.
So generic, we want to make it more applicable to OPD.
So let's go down two pages, Stephen. Schedule M, we made a change there to make sure that we were listed as a government entity. And then let's go to the next page. So on Article 5, Byron had some concerns about notices that were given in the event of defaults or different other things. Do you want to talk about that, Byron? Or do you want...
It was just about the time frame.
The time frame, yeah.
I was just worried that we had specifically, I think, we had 2 days, I believe, to respond if we had certain concerns or if they provided notice we had to respond within 2 days. And I was just concerned that that's just not a lot of time for us to adequately respond and Apropolis, especially if we are trying to figure out numbers and such like that. So it looks like we've increased that to 5 days,
yeah.
Which, again, made me more comfortable knowing that we had a few more days to make sure we were right in responding to any problems or potential corrections or issues that we had.
And at all times, we're talking about business days, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, business
well,
days.
Just so that on, you don't get that note on Friday.
Friday.
And lose 3 days.
Yeah.
So we're always talking about business days.
Yeah. And then another concern Byron had was Article 8. And so you can see at the bottom of the page, 8.3. And Tanaska was, Nick was very good to work with us on all of these things. Byron had a concern about, you know, us being a government entity in under a default, you know, he had some concern about the things were in there, and Nick added to the extent permitted by applicable law, which Byron was asking for. So that worked out well. And then let's
basically
go.
Basically saying that they had a lien on all our assets and our customer receivables, and that we basically gave them an ownership interest, which as a public entity, we can't give an ownership interest at all into our company. So.
Okay, let's go down two pages to page 9. Well, let's go a couple more. We want to go to page 9. So this was the other change here is Nick added in here a reference to NRS 318, which is our governing law under Nevada Revised Statute. And so those are the edits that we've made to this agreement as compared to what was online. So that's the cover sheet. Does anybody have any questions about anything else that's in the cover sheet? Okay. Let's go to the transaction confirmation then. And so this outlines the... No, that's scheduling services. We want... We'll do that one next, Stephen.
We might not have one of them.
Oh, yeah.
It's the
second from the bottom.
Yeah, there you go, TC. Okay, thank you. Those younger eyes. Thank you.
You got these things memorized, Nick.
We just made, I believe, just one edit to this. No, there's two. There's a couple of edits. A couple of things we changed here as you go down. Let's go to the next page, Stephen. An edit we made here was in that bottom paragraph you see Mesquite that's in bold. We added in here, we deliver 1 megawatt of Schedule D Hoover for the city of Mesquite. And so that was included in here. And then if you go two more pages, Stephen, to four, we go to thresholds. And it wasn't just me. I have a power supply team. I have Melissa on that team because she does the finances. I have Randall in here because he does our coordinating of all of our renewables. And I have Kevin who does the scheduling. So the four of us went through these things together and I got input from these guys. And so I want to make sure that I recognize these guys for helping me and giving me input on this. But as we worked with Nick, we expressed our concerns about, you know, the responsibilities that we have with this contract and how it all fit and coordinated between the base price and anything that goes outside the bandwidth. And so Nick was very good to talk to us. We talked to him about every hour. I think we were on the phone together last week saying, does this work? Does that work? You know, just going back and forth on things. And so he modified this part, and then if you go to the end of the contract.
If I can just show that real quick.
Yeah.
On that page right there, the seller load obligation percentage is listed at 100%. And you may say, well, wait a minute, we've got solar, we've got hydro, right? And this is because they're going to do just like Morgan Stanley did. They're taking the solar and hydro and bringing it back through the system to us, correct? That's
you're scheduling it up.
Yeah.
Okay, so we work on that. And then if you go to the end of the contract, it has the thresholds for the bandwidths. And again, we went through those with a fine-tooth comb, and Nick did too, and made adjustments that we all agreed upon.
Go back up two pages, please, just so they can see.
So that's our schedule to make sure that we agree where we should be in the process. So that's the transaction confirmation. Do you guys have any other questions about that from anything you've seen or other comments, Byron?
I don't.
Okay.
I think when we discussed it, we covered so much of my issues.
And one of the yes, Rich.
Do we have say we get another large customer on? They will not be included in this contract. Is it anything over 1.5 megawatts?
1.5 megawatts.
So they'll have to have a separate contract.
Yes. Yeah. And the other thing is Nick is also programmed in that we're allowed 2% growth every year of our loads. So essentially that, and historically that's what we've been, somewhere between 1.9 and 2.1% load growth every year. So at 2%, he's allowing us to continue to grow into that contract. If something comes in that's bigger than 1.5 megawatts, we'll negotiate with them to see if it fits in under the current situation or whether it needs to be a special contract.
And we're still doing a monthly bandwidth and not a quarterly, is that correct?
Just doing a monthly, but you remember we talked about that at the last board meeting. It was a monthly at 125% of the price, and I talked to Nick about that, and he says we want to continue monthly, but we can go at 110%. Okay. So that fits in with what we were looking for too.
So why don't you want to do quarterly?
More just isolating, right, if something happens in a given month to what may be happening in the market. We adjusted to get in line with the percentages that you had in your current contract.
So the biggest challenge the biggest challenges we face in these contracts, and one of the things that both Tenaska and Morgan Stanley both told me is the market has changed since you've done your last contract. And you've seen that in those shrapnel prices that we've shown you about how expensive things get in certain hours of the day depending on what's going on. So we've tried to nail this down as tight as we can under a normal circumstance, because if you try to go outside that, you start paying for the risk and it starts really driving up the price of the contract. So we've tried to be as accurate and as thorough as we can be, but we still have risk based on what the weather does or any economic or world events. And those aren't our fault. It's not Tenaska's fault either when those things happen. So Good question, though.
On the solar, at least in the beginning, it was 25 megs, right? Megawatts?
Mm-hmm.
The plant down at Primus had a lot of trouble with having to fill in the generation when the clouds come over or something. How do we handle that? Or how is that handled?
So, if you'll recall, in our solar contract, we set, kind of similar to what Tenaska is doing with us, we set thresholds in that contract that they have to meet certain levels of production, or they have to compensate us for missing those production levels.
Okay, and so when that happens, they schedule more for us,
mm-hmm.
but it costs more, or something like that, right?
If it pushes us out of the bandwidth.
Yeah, but the solar company is responsible to pick up that sort of difference, right?
We will get a check from the solar company, and hopefully it's enough to cover what we have to pay extra to not ask it.
as you ran scenarios, now that it's monthly on bandwidth, we expect to have more of those fees, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's your expectation, appetite for that?
So currently we've paid four times we've been outside the bandwidth of Morgan Stanley, and it's totaled up through the year about $600 to $7,000 a year, and we've nailed this down with Tenaska to where we're within that same range.
But that was one of the changes that you see with those bandwidths is we really tightened that down and said, okay, what is this going to cost us? That's something that we negotiated with Nick in changing those bandwidths to fit our needs even just a little bit better. So that's why those are redlined out, because we have changed each month and dialed that down for assumptions on what is going to be our upper and lower loads for both peak and off-peak, and taking in hydro and solar into consideration.
When you say it'll be the same, based on what happened
based
in the
on
past,
historical, yeah. Yeah.
If it was the same scenario, we would be near the same line.
Yeah. And that's the challenge. You know, we don't have that crystal ball to know what's going on in the future. So we've tried to base everything off historical as close as we can, trying to anticipate.
We have to guess.
Yeah. Any challenges we had before, we're trying to program those into the future.
I understand why you went lower on the lower, but why did we go lower on the upper on the ranges?
Do you want to talk about that, Nick?
Yeah.
Because we talked about that last week.
Yeah, a lot of the big driver, too, is making sure that you guys were able to incorporate a lot of the hydro that you get from CRC. And so you've been getting some layoff from Parker Davis, and it's been pretty significant for you all. And so originally that hadn't been incorporated because I think there was some uncertainty of whether you guys would continue to be able to get that extra hydro above your contracted amounts into the future. But based on conversations we had with them over the last week or so, it sounds like those deliveries should continue well into the future. So we were making sure that it was accommodating you guys getting that extra low-cost federal hydro that wasn't included prior. So.
And the second part of that is if we way over schedule and don't use it, we pay a premium for that because they're giving us something that we may not use, and we're going to pay for it.
So this drives the price down?
Yes. Well, yes, it keeps the price lower. It has come up a little bit. Part of it's because of this, and part of it because change in the market. But yeah, we had to do this to keep it from going up into the 90s. Okay, our last agreement is the scheduling services agreement. If you'll pull that up, Stephen. Not much change to this. I think the only thing we did here is I added my contact information, our contact information at the end, and I put in the description of the company in the first paragraph. That's all we changed there. So those are the contracts with edits. So if we decide to move forward, we're going to ask you to approve the contracts with edits and then designate somebody to sign these agreements so that we can execute these at the right time. If you want to meet, in the past we've had the board chair do that. But in the interest of time, because we have to act, you know, when the prices are right. I'm okay doing that if you want me to, but you guys have to designate that.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, let's talk price a little bit. So we have been talking, you know, I gave you some prices last time. There, like I just mentioned, there's been some adjustments because of adjustments to the bandwidth, and there's been some a little bit of market creep that's come up, and we've seen the price come up. What about a $1.50 a megawatt hour? Is that about where we're at?
Yeah, we were.
So we were at 86.
25. And right now, as of today, it was looking around 87.75. A good chunk of that was the change in the bands and having that hydro, allowing you to get that extra hydro there. And then the market a little bit. The market, it changes on a daily basis, right, when there's anything going on, right? It could be Iran, Israel. It could be there's a pipeline explosion in Alberta yesterday. So those types of things can make the market fluctuate from day to day, but it's been a little bit of both that have contributed to this.
So during these contract negotiations, when I woke up Sunday and saw that Iran was firing missiles at Israel, my heart leapt because I thought this is going to kill our power contract. So what we want to do is we want to be able to go a little bit above that. Do you feel comfortable saying that if we can be underneath $88 that you'll give us approval to sign that? Is that acceptable to the board?
What's the time frame? What are our options? I mean,
our options are, first of all, we could wait clear till, you know, November if we wanted to. What we're doing is just taking on risk. So, you know, I talked to Nick about today, I said if we set a price and can get under that, can we do this tomorrow? He said yes, or, you know, within the next few days. So I want to make sure that I get approval from you to transact this, but it has to be within the range that you think in case we see prices come up a little bit.
Well, let's take that 86.5 and 2.5 and we'll sign up tomorrow.
That's what I told him today.
It sounds logical on this side of the world.
Before we talk also about I assume this is a 3-year price?
Yes.
Yeah.
We talked about a 5-year. I think some of us are more interested in that, and some are more interested in the shorter term.
So
what's the status on a 5-year?
So we looked at, you know, last time the board was kind of split, and so what we did as a staff is we went back and we looked at, you know, what's going on in the next 3 to 5 years. We understand that there's supposed to be a change in the market, going to maybe rather than hourly or 15-minute, you know, right now some people are scheduling 15-minute. We have to submit hourly schedules, but we're hearing stories that we may be within a 5-minute market, and that happens in 2028. So we thought maybe based on that, the three-year contract made sense. We also see the majority of our CFC loans drop off in 2028, which would also give us a better indication of how much adjustment we have. And then there's the thing about the Nevada markets. We don't know what's going to happen with that, and we're hoping that by the end of 2027 there's a little more clarity there. So we thought that it was probably a little bit more in line and not to spend extra money, just keep it at a 3-year contract and try and stay within the realm of all the changes that are going to happen.
You know, the price, events in the world tend to make the price jump up. Bad news. Good news doesn't depress it that much. It seems to me that 3 years is pretty wise. And, of course, who can tell what's going to happen in the election? That may make a big difference in the availability of petroleum products.
It really could. And it,
which will drive the price down, but who knows?
Yeah.
So I want to understand it. Right now, we're not even looking at a 5-year anymore.
You know, when I talked to Nick, it caused a lot of extra work to go on. And I told him based on what I felt that I was hearing that And from what we saw, that the 3-year contract was probably the thing that we wanted to look at. And if you tell me I'm wrong, then we'll work on the 5-year.
Well, what do we need to do, Judy?
Well, does the board want to vote on if they want to make a motion on a 3-year or 5-year or further looking at it? I personally do not. I think they've gone above and beyond getting the information that they have for us. But as usual, I am open to whatever this board wants. So if you guys feel that you should have, you want to check out a 5-year, then you need to make a motion and we need to vote on it.
I think what we saw, though, that a 5-year was going to be more expensive.
$1.5 million for those first 3 years.
You're paying more for that additional security on the out.
Yeah, I'm content with the contract. I just...
It just sucks.
Doesn't like the prices.
No offense to you guys.
But like natural gas prices haven't, that I've seen, haven't come up. So is it just risk in the world that's causing $1.50 to go up? Or
so you tell me if I'm wrong here, but from the discussions that I've been in, not with just Tenasca, but Morgan Stanley and some others, what's tending to drive the price in the West is the fact that there are fewer and fewer firm resources. Everything is going to renewable, and there's very few coal, gas plants that can provide firm resources, and the prices for the firm resources are being bid up, and that's what's driving the price right now. Is that correct?
Yeah, the June through September kind of time period doesn't really correlate to natural gas prices out here in the West. It's just more of a scarcity kind of supply-demand issue in general. So Linda's is correct. The number of coal assets have been shut down over the last 10 years. And so you just have fewer. And no one's really built any new natural gas of any kind of significant size. And so that plays in. So weather forecasts tend to be a big driver. So if the forecast is to be warmer, it's going to push those June and Q3, third quarter electric prices up, which draws the whole calendar year.
It was kind of interesting when I was at the CREA meeting and WAPA was talking about this very thing. And, you know, we've talked in here about the duck curve, how if you start in the morning and go through the day, the power use curve kind of looks like this. And WAPA is seeing now that the duck curve looks like this. It gets up in the morning and then it goes clear down to where they were seeing negative prices during the middle of the day because there's too much solar, and then the end of the day it was going back up. So it's not even really a duck curve anymore. That whole bottom section has just dropped out because of the proliferation of solar and batteries that are in the area and the lack of resources in those other times during the day, and that's what's driving the prices up.
And basically, we have to make a decision. Do we want to wait and see if we can get it cheaper? Do you want to take that chance? Because, I mean, we can carry on discussions.
I would like to see us go ahead and take what we can get now. I think we're better off. We may overpay a little bit, but it's going to be for a fewer years. I don't think we're going to... I don't think the price is going to skyrocket more.
Well, my big fear is, and this the reason we're bringing this to you now, is 6 months ago we were looking at prices from $105 to $110 a megawatt hour. Yeah. And prices have been coming down. The risk is what's going to happen going forward. What could happen to drive that price back up? We may see the market go down a little bit more. It's never going to get back down to where we are now, I don't think.
It's definitely not going to get back down to where we were.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just...
And I just threw that last statement in there just in case it does. I want to say, well, I didn't,
Would you agree to a price match? So if the price drops, within the next 7 days, have to be signed and match that price? Best Buy does it.
That was a hard no.
So do you want, you say 8-8 is what you...
I think 88 would be, that would that cover us okay? And we'll try and get it under that.
5.5, would that cover us okay? I'm serious. 5.5 is long. Would 87.5 cover us?
I think just based on where we said today, I think we're targeting to get it 87.75, but we're just looking for that 25 cent buffer on it. It was.
So not agreeing. He's not asking.
I know. And 50 cents is 50 cents.
What we've talked about is if it was approved, it would be to try to lock things in right away, just because things can, in the near term, impact prices.
Especially when people are dropping bombs.
Yeah, it does. And it's at a low point. Like I've told Mendes, if we came to you in November and gave you pricing, it would have been over $100 for the same product. So it's at a low point that we've seen in the last 24 months.
I don't want to be this 3 and 5 years from you, Jeff. I kind of want to have my opinion set. In my business, what we did, when we found a number that worked for us and we were comfortable with it, we would buy like all of our feed for the year. And we could make money at that price. You're talking about all these things in the world making the price go up. That's why we're talking about like hurrying and jumping on this. I just like have kind of a struggle thinking that in 3 years with all the crap that's going on, we're going to find cheaper power. Maybe we will. But I feel like I'm pretty comfortable with the increase we're going to have in our power bill. And if I could set that for 5 years, I would be happy with that. I don't want to have to raise it again in 3 years. I don't feel like there's a big possibility of getting a much cheaper power bill to the customers in 3 years. And definitely, I don't feel like there's as much of an opportunity for it to go down as there is for it to go up. That's why I'm more comfortable with the 5 year. You guys made a good argument, and I'm not 100%. I want 5 years. It's, I'm kind of like 60-40 or maybe 75-25. I recognize that for 3 years we're going to pay more if we do.
Yeah.
A 5 year.
Yeah.
He's been looking at the polls and seeing that President Biden has slipped ahead of President Trump in the polls. That's why he wants the 5 years. If President Trump beats President Biden, then prices will likely come down. Well, my crystal ball says prices will come down, and you will want that 3 year over 5 year. But there's too many other circumstances too, right? Maybe the Russia war ends and opens up, floods the market with natural gas again out of Russia. Maybe. It's a risk both ways, right? 3 to 5 years, 3 years, we may be kicking ourselves saying, wow, I wish we had done a shorter contract because it's now at 55 and we're stuck at 78 or whatever.
Let's not get 78 out there.
So do I, Byron.
We have a, yeah, okay. Well, if somebody wants to make a motion, I'm more than happy to entertain it.
I'll make a motion that we sign a 3-year contract, give Mendes the power to sign for us at maximum 88, is that right? Maximum 88.
Okay. With the additional edits?
Hmm?
With the additional edits, right?
Yeah, edits.
Oh, yes. I know what
agreements.
He said. He said
you heard
he approves the contract with edits, allowing the general manager / CEO to execute the 3-year contract with Tenasca Power Services Incorporated with a maximum $88 per megawatt hour.
You really speak softly. Not
that's exactly what
you
said.
You just hear the rest of it? Hi, my gosh, your hearing aid must be turned out.
That's it. Okay, do I hear a
second?
Okay, and Dale seconded it. Seconds in. There's been a motion and a second to do what Becky said. to do what Becky wrote down when she read it back to us. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
One nay.
One nay.
Five. One.
Okay. He'll have that signed tomorrow morning.
At 87.75.
At 87.5.
Or less.
Because you're so nice there. There'll be no giggling in the peanut gallery. Okay, I'm sorry. It's a big deal, and I make jokes, but it's a big deal. So
thank you.
It's a large move.
Welcome to the family.
If prices drop overnight, I guess there is still an opportunity.
Yeah, he hasn't signed
yet.
He hasn't signed yet, and of course, if they drop, of course, they will give us that lower price.
They will.
Okay, any board comments?
Would you like to do public comments first?
Oh, yeah, but I had writing over by that.
Okay.
So I'll move that writing to where it belongs. Item J, public comments. None? Board comments.
Is there going to be a closed door today?
Yep.
Have your attention. Okay.
No board comments?
I'd say that we really thank the staff. You guys have done a heck of a job. This is pretty complex stuff. And, you know, you're in the power business, not necessarily the power negotiation price business. But you've done a wonderful job for us, I think.
We spent some late nights in full spreadsheet mode analyzing this last week, so it was...
Yeah, but you love that spreadsheet
stuff. I do. I love it. I love the spreadsheet stuff.
I think that's good. Great job.
Yeah, I would like to also thank you guys. I wanted a longer term, but I'm, like, happy. And this is going to be great to get this tied up and know what's going on. Thank you for all your time and
thank you.
Expertise.
Well, it keeps us, we just had our, from CRC, just had our rate study. It keeps us below what they figured on our rate study. They were at $90. So it keeps us below their estimate on the rate study.
On the rate study, I read something different than that. So we probably need to...
It was 89.
Well, we'll be
talking
about
that. They were 6.7, I thought.
That's the increase, but they base that on $89 per megawatt hour charge they did.
I didn't see that in the report there. It is in there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're right on the money where we are.
I'll help you find it.
Any more comments? Nobody? Okay, item L, approval of the next board meeting, May 15th in Overton. Do I hear a motion?
I have a motion that way. Meeting May 15th, 3 o'clock in Overton.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded for the next meeting. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, we'll close this meeting and go into executive session.
Okay, thank you.
Just, you want to go straight to it?
Okay, we're excused.